The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Lee Alexander. The clocks have changed, pumpkin heads are out, so this week things are going to take a dark turn.
So I ended up looking at trolling subcultures, neo-Nazi subcultures, suicide forums. It was quite difficult to research, but it was always far more morally ambiguous, far more complex, far more nuanced than I'd ever imagined. So yes, it's shocking, but not always in the ways that you think.
Yes, this week we'll be discussing the secret layers of the World Wide Web, the so-called dark net, with author Jamie Bartlett, director of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media. Also, we'll be discussing the growing popularity of the horror writing community on Reddit, with the disconcerting title of R No Sleep, the murky world of the Bitcoin entrepreneur, and will artificial intelligence be the end of us all? Elon Musk certainly thinks so. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me this week, we have the Young Turks of the tech team. Tech reporter Samuel Gibbs. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
And Alex Hearn.
Hiya.
Hello, Alex. And joining us for the first time is Crack Guardian Community Coordinator Elena Cressy. A warm welcome to you, Elena.
Thanks. Hi. Nice to be here.
Alex, let's begin with an article you wrote this week on the missing British Bitcoin entrepreneur Alex Green. Reads like a crime novel. Would you like to tell us more?
Sure. So the Bitcoin community, the Bitcoin world, is no shortage of companies which spring up and then disappear. It's essentially, you know, you have invented a currency which is specifically for transferring large amounts of money beneath the oversight of the traditional banking system. That doesn't tend to encourage the sort of corporate governance that you might wish for.
Really?
No. I mean, it's surprising. I'm surprised too. Who'd have thought that a wholly cash economy could have some shady elements? One such company recently that went bankrupt was called Moolah.io. It was a Bitcoin exchange, so it let you buy and sell Bitcoin and other currencies. But it was actually better known for its relationship to the meme-based cryptocurrency Dogecoin.
Oh, I know you're a big fan of the meme-based cryptocurrency Dogecoin.
All meme-based cryptocurrencies,
so
really.
So you're still pronouncing it Dogecoin?
I mean,
I thought it was Doge.
It is.
Doge is a philosopher.
I like Dogecoin. I also quite like Doggycoin, which just sounds happiest.
This is a subject of much pub debate in our social circle. Continue.
Etymologically, I don't know. But anyway, Dogecoin is a Bitcoin spin-off which has not really anything to sell it other than the fact that it's got a picture of a happy Shiba Inu.
Which is
both the only selling point and the only important selling point.
Many cryptocurrency. Wow.
So, Moolah... essentially, it began as a Bitcoin exchange, but actually made quite a large inlet to Dogecoin to such an extent that Alex Green, the head of Moolah, was in many ways the man who owned Dogecoin. He wasn't the founder, he wasn't in charge of the corporation, but almost all of the actual money involved in this fledgling cryptocurrency went through his corporation. A few months back when the Dogecoin foundations or Dogecoin users sponsored a NASCAR driver, putting the happy Shiba Inu on the front of a car of one of America's most popular spectator sports, a lot of the money came directly from Alex Green.
His
personal investment, as you do if you're trying to get attention on your meme-based cryptocurrency. But last week, disaster struck. Moolah declared bankruptcy. In some ways, it had come out of nowhere.
But things were going so well.
At the same time, there was always a little bit of weirdness about Moolah. There was some shadiness around the securities that were issued by Moolah. They were putting out what they were calling pie, as in slice of the pie. You could, in effect, invest in Moolah and get a portion of its future profits. That's not, you know, 100% okay. America and Britain have organizations in charge of regulating the issuing of securities. You can't just sell shares. Anyway, turns out the day before it declares bankruptcy, Alex Green writes a blog post revealing that Alex Green is not his birth name. He was born Ryan Kennedy.
Just for a point of clarification, Alex, Ryan Kennedy is not being prosecuted.
No. And in fact, this is, you know, the Bitcoin world is an interesting one. of all of the places where someone could legitimately be operating under a pseudonym and running quite a valuable business, Bitcoin is one. It's a network that's built around ideas of computational trust, of removing what the normal offline world sees as elements of trust, of real names and, you know, putting a picture next to your statements. And instead, it argues strongly that you can replace this with cryptographic elements of trust. You can sign your statements with a PGP key. You can attach money in the blockchain to an official statement so that it's marked at some particular time. And the mere fact of using another name shouldn't be enough to slam Kennedy.
So while users may be wary of his history, we have no proof that anything illegal is going on.
No, not at all. At the same time, personally, I think users should have been aware of his history, as in whether or not operating under a false name or a different name is reason for suspicion. I doubt many users of Moolah would have cashed in if they'd known Ryan Kennedy's history or the allegations against Kennedy. It seems he's moved on now, but he maintains he is planning on giving the money back. I've actually been in conversation with him. He says they've already returned around 3,000 Bitcoin. There's 800 Bitcoin missing due to hackers. They've processed 2,500 worth and can expect to process another 1,500 worth. This is millions of pounds, which he says is working its way back through the system to the users. Hmm. Obviously, the problem is if you begin your high users, we've gone bankrupt, but don't worry, you're all going to get all your money back conversation with. Also, I have another name which is associated with a long string of failed ventures where not everyone maybe got their money back. The users are naturally not entirely confident with his promises.
So, it'd be interesting to see how that develops. Is there anything else we should know about that particular story? Where should we look for more information on that?
Well, if you're a Moolah investor, you should perhaps join in the High Court injunction, which is going out against Ryan Kennedy, as he has now reverted to being known. If you're not a Moolah investor, it's currently still all rather shady. I and many other reporters are trying to get to the bottom of it. We're following the story to see if Ryan Kennedy does indeed return all the money he has, and if even the claims of being a hack can stand up, and if there is some third party who's actually got most of this money. Beyond that, the best thing is, if you are thinking of getting into Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, meme-based or not, try going with companies that have a bit of a history, a solid background, and maybe actual verifiable claims of insurance and stuff. These are nice things to have if you're going to put thousands of pounds into fake money.
Certainly. If you want to learn more about Bitcoin, just go to theguardian.com/technology. Also, we'll have on the blog for this podcast a link to our Bitcoin special edition we recorded earlier this year. Well worth a listen for all the ins and outs of that. Halloween is on the horizon, and we're all up for a good scare. That makes it the best time to delve into some of the best independent DIY horror writing on the web. According to Elena Cressy, it's to be found on Reddit. Elena, tell us some more.
Yeah, it is. I am obsessed with this subreddit, and it's been around for a while. It's r/nosleep. So basically, it's the online version of telling ghost stories around the campfire, and it's home to some of the creepiest short and long stories that you'll find on the internet, and it's just people just writing them just for fun half the time. And what you've got peppered in these stories as well are like little nods to modern culture, like Facebook, Twitter and all this, which makes it seem really real. And when you're on No Sleep, it is real. You're not meant to question it. You don't have Redditors going and saying, yeah, but that wouldn't happen, that's not real, because as far as they're concerned, it's all real, which makes it really great. And it's sort of a collaborative process with the stories.
People are using the medium of the internet itself to create this sort of viral folklore, like a creepy screenshots from Facebook with mm-hmm. someone's picture in looking odd or something.
Yeah, that's a big part of what No Sleep does. Like, there was a story earlier this year that was called My Dead Girlfriend Keeps Sending Me Facebook Messages.
I've read that one.
Yeah, this was the one that actually fooled a lot of news places, where they were like, oh my God, this guy has been getting messages from his dead girlfriend and it's horrendous. No, he wasn't. It was a guy just writing the story. It's on No Sleep. I mean, you know, as far as No Sleep is concerned, that did actually happen.
But there were screen caps, there were photos, it felt very immersive.
Yeah, that's the key to it, really, is that they immerse the readers, and that's why it's become so popular. I mean, I was just looking at it earlier, and it's got almost 1.5 million subscribers now. I mean, that's not how many people who'd be writing on it, but that's how many people are reading. And they're always really interesting. And that one, my dead girlfriend keeps sending me Facebook messages, was just brilliant, because it just seemed so real, because we all know what it's like to just get a random Facebook message every now and then, but imagine getting that from someone that you think is dead, and especially when you've got so many Facebook profiles still out there, and it's like, I'm getting goosebumps now, it's quite creepy.
Me too. You know, I think it's really cool the way that social media has enabled us to do new communal storytelling, new kinds of folklore and horror stories that use the medium that we participate in. Alex, you've got some favorites.
Yeah, I mean, I've literally been getting distracted while we've been speaking, going through one of my favorite, which is the SCP Foundation's wiki.
What does SCP stand for?
SCP stands for Secure, Contain, Protect. Ooh. And much like No Sleep, you know, this is a vast work of collaborative fiction, which doesn't refer to its own fictional status at all in the world. What we have is the collaborative encyclopedia for the SCP Foundation, which is a top secret foundation charged with finding and reporting on stuff that doesn't quite fit.
It's unnatural phenomena.
It's the sort of overarching story that you see in geek fiction time and again. But what's so great about this is that the framework of it lends itself perfectly to this collaborative storytelling, and it lends itself to a consistency of tone, because what you're reading are not ghost stories.
It's wiki entries.
Yeah, what you're reading are bureaucratic paperwork about items recovered from ghost stories, which
it's really fascinating,
right? And it both makes it a lot easier for a huge number of different authors to come in and write something that feels like it's one consistent universe, because it's a lot easier to write consistent bureaucratic tone than it is to write consistent in the first person.
And that almost makes it creepier, because you're just reading these boring reports and these wrong little details are start creeping in.
And some of them are scary. Some of them are just outright horror stories told through observations of patients, observations of objects. And some of them are weirder. Some of them are even quite funny. One of my favorite ones is a very, very short entry. It's just four lines. Item SCP blank. Object class blank. Special containment procedures in a box in my office. Description: it's a rock that makes you procrastinate. Addendum: probably mimetic or something. I'll finish writing this up later. Dr. Van.
And oh, that's amazing.
That's not scary, obviously. No. That's using the form of this wonderful collaborative thing to tell a little joke, an in-universe joke. And actually, that's the sort of item that can exist anywhere. Then you go on and there's a locket that heals everything, but it heals you a bit too well, and some people who have had too many injuries become these flesh beasts. But it's all told vaguely, it's all told secondarily, and my favorite thing about it makes heavy use of redaction. So just when something's about to get to stop being scary because you find out too much about it, there's a massive blank space, and you're left going, what is it, what's it do?
Tell me. I think there's just one more that I'd quite like to mention, just because it's an old one, about a haunted Majora's Mask game, and it's amazing. You need to go look it up.
I read
it's
the one so about good. The haunted Pokemon cartridge.
Yes, it's a similar thing, because this one's, it's not from No Sleep, it's Creepypasta, which is kind of like, you know, where you copy and paste scary stories. And I was looking it up earlier because I was a bit too scared to watch the videos, because I don't like it when I watch the videos. I went and looked up the images and they looked really creepy. I don't really want to ruin it.
I have to recommend
much,
the
brilliant.
I have to recommend the Marble Hornet series on YouTube.
Oh yeah. Oh. That one's amazing. Yeah.
it is a sort of interpretation of the Slender Man mythos. And Slender Man is a horrific figure that was invented on the internet and by the internet. So in a way, he's the perfect creep for our modern age. Elena, if we want to learn more about horror stories online, where can we find some of your favourites?
Well, you can go to reddit.com/r/nosleep, and there's loads of stories there, always updated all the time. We're also going to be doing a roundup of some of the best stories that you can find on No Sleep, and feel free to suggest your own as well.
When I think of what I'm most afraid of in the future, the robot revolution is not the first thing that comes to mind. But Sam, according to your story, Elon Musk says that AI could pose the greatest existential threat to humanity that there is.
Bigger than nukes.
Bigger than nukes,
yeah.
AI.
He, see, Musk, was, let me set the scene. Musk is basically, he's been compared to Tony Stark. So he is the technology entrepreneur. He has in high technology. He's got an electric car company. He's got a space travel company.
Potential secret supersuit.
He is, as close as you can get to a comic book character, he is it. And he's not the kind of person you take lightly when he has fears about a piece of technology, because he's very much technology focused. So some people stand up and take notice. Now, this isn't the first time Musk has said, oh, we should be wary of AI. This is the second time. But he's come out and specifically said that he feels, like you said, it is the biggest existential threat to humanity, and that it's basically a demon. AI is the demon you cannot put back in the bag, can't control. Once it's out there, it's done. And he's the first high-profile guy who's not actively researching it, but in a grander sphere, calling for some regulatory oversight. I mean, his fears are basically based around AI not needing us. So we invent AI. AI has, if you think of AI as, there are two types of AI. There's AI which has a narrow field of focus and can do something specifically well. That's what we're likely to create first. And then there's super intelligence, the AI that is capable of basically outthinking one of us, maybe all of us, and therefore we're not needed. So this singular AI, kind of, I'll paint a picture for you. You create a computer that its very job is just to make paperclips, right? And you make it intelligent in enough that it is able to optimize its own production of paperclips. Now, that in itself doesn't seem scary. But when you realize what, if you set it this goal, you must make as many paperclips as possible, with intelligence to be able to write stuff, change stuff about itself, suddenly that task becomes quite dangerous to us, because we're sitting on land that could contain metal for paperclips. We also, where are we going to store all these paperclips? What happens when we don't want it to make paperclips anymore? We go and turn it off, right? But its goal is always to make paperclips. So
perhaps it could outsmart us so that we can't turn off the paperclip machine.
You know, it's just going to fire paperclips at us until we're all dead. That kind of thing. I mean, it's that kind of...
Now this is a Halloween episode, yeah, friends.
So he basically says that we should have some sort of regulation over this. He's been investing in AI companies, including Google's DeepMind, not from the purpose of wanting to further it, but for keeping an eye on it. That's what he said. I invest in these companies for keeping an eye on how it's going. Now, I mean... You know, we're not doomsday scenario just yet. We are not anywhere near to actually creating super intelligence. It's a very, very slow process. But at some point, in theory, it's going to hit an exponential growth, and away we go. So he represents one side of the kind of like AI danger scenario. There is another one, of course, that AI is going to be friendly, and you know, so it's basically the Terminator versus AI. You know, friendly robots versus the ones that want to kill us, and it's a debate that has been raging in sci-fi for a while, but not really in academic circles, perhaps, but not in the wider social sphere.
What I find quite interesting is that typically this debate has had two sides. There's been the one side of people who think about it and go, you know what, this is all nonsense. The side that goes, actually, either general purpose intelligence is harder than we give it credit for, or that it will never come out of nowhere, that we'll always be able to see it coming. You know, this side that says essentially it's not worth worrying about, or if it is worth worrying about, it is worth worrying about in the same class as other things like biological epidemics or asteroids. These are all things that we should keep an eye on, and if they look dangerous, we should act. The other side typically is the side that says, no, not only will this definitely come because simply making computers faster will get there eventually, it will also come out of nowhere, because the minute you create something which can improve its own intelligence full stop, it will then get super intelligent enough to wipe us all out before we can even act. That side doesn't typically say we shouldn't be developing AI, because they think it's inevitable. So what you get, what people like Professor Bostrom recommend, is we should try and make nice AI first. That essentially, if we accidentally make AI, it will try and kill us. So we should try to make good AI, we should try and beat the people who will accidentally make it to the AI thing, so that the first AI that ever exists has programmed into it from the core, be nice to people and don't kill them and, you know, be friendly, try and improve the lot of humanity.
So let's first make the ones whose, you know, inherent ability to feel, we can feel guilty and empathetic about, right, before we make the ones that are going to march and attack us.
Which does lead to the quite interesting thing that a lot of AI researchers are now trying to solve ethics, just completely sit down and write ethics.
It sounds so surreal to me. Right. The entire thing sounds completely surreal. Like, I realise that it's probably an inevitability, but at the same time,
what is it? You know, we have a number of films where the machines take over in some way or another, but how close are we really right now to developing the technology that will allow machines to be intelligent?
I mean, to hear some of them, we're 20, 25 years away from the first ability to bootstrap a machine. But what I find quite interesting about Musk's statements is that, like I say, most people who are afraid of this, in fact, almost all of them are responding by saying we need to build friendly AI, which to me seems counterintuitive. You know, you're saying there is an it's like saying, you know, we're worried about being hit by asteroids, so we should try and fly straight at an asteroid. Or we're worried, or saying we're worried about Ebola wiping everyone out, so let's all go and catch Ebola, but make sure we catch an easy strain of Ebola. But they're thinking of it more like vaccination. You know, you get exposed to a friendly AI, which can then help you. Musk is the first person I've seen who's thought about this, got scared about it, and actually sat back and gone, maybe we could regulate this. Mm. Like, maybe if we're actually afraid of AI, we should treat it like we treat nuclear research. We obviously want it to happen. Good things can come of it. And we also want it to happen because if we completely ban it, only the bad guys will have bad AI. But maybe we shouldn't just have people like Google dicking around with AI and going, oh, I wonder what happens if I plug this super intelligent computer into this 3D printer.
What do you folks think regulation would look like?
Well, see, that's a tough one because basically stopping people doing research, I mean, the very basic level is it's just programming. I mean, yes, there's a lot of supercomputing involved in it at the moment, but that's not to say that happening further forward. So anyone with a computer could be working on this.
I mean, I think there's some fairly obvious ones, which is right now anyone with a computer could be working on it, but the breakthroughs are still coming from universities and from massive companies with huge research arms like Google. So enforceability doesn't seem impossible. What I would say the obvious stuff to do is, for instance, put an air gap in. If you have a computer which you're trying to work on extremely strong AI with, maybe don't plug it into the internet. And it sounds laughable, but actually that's not a regulation which is enforced. That
top tip.
It's completely legal and fine, and no one seems to raise an eyebrow to go like, oh yeah, no, you know, I'm definitely trying actively to create AI smarter than humanity on a machine which I've plugged in to a whole network of other computers which are easily compromisable. No, I don't see a problem with that. Do you?
Maybe that's where all the dead girlfriend Facebook messages are coming from.
Maybe. We've solved it.
We've got Halloween story to link them all together.
But my favourite bit about this story is about how he said that he invests in all these companies just to keep an eye on them. That sounds really spooky. Am I the only one who thinks that? Possibly.
it's interesting, and the UK is at the forefront of this. I mean, you've only got to look at Google's recent purchases. DeepMind was a massive one, biggest in Europe. That was beginning of the year, and it's now just bought another two startups out of the University of Oxford. The UK is where all this is happening, and are we going to be the harbingers of doom?
Maybe.
We're opening the gates to Robot Hill directly from here. Just wanted to thank everybody for joining me today, Elena, Sam, and Alex.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank
you.
And for more on our stories, please go to theguardian.com/technology.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Let's imagine a very 21st century digital take on hell, a place where evil resides and where dark souls engage. It must be the mainstream media's take on what's called the dark net. Even the name sends shivers down the spine. We tend to imagine that the dark net is a place where neo-Nazis meet jihadis, where drug dealers and pornographers meet cryptocurrency libertarians. But for Jamie Bartlett, this vast digital world is little understood. His recent book, The Dark Net, sets out to explore a world where, in theory, people have complete anonymity and freedom. I met up with Jamie and started out by asking him the most obvious of questions. What is the Dark Net?
My book, The Dark Net, was really about trying to immerse myself, meet the people, and understand these sort of hidden internet subcultures. Mm-hmm. That goes from really the sort of encrypted corner of the internet that's sometimes called the dark net, Tor hidden services, this anonymous world online, but actually includes Facebook groups and 4chan and Reddit, these different cultures and communities of people that where they push the extremities of anonymity, I suppose, what they do under those conditions of anonymity. And so I ended up looking at trolling subcultures, neo-Nazi subcultures, suicide forums, child pornography communities, dark net web sites that sold drugs. And in each case, this is the thing. In each case, it sounds terrifying, it sounds shocking, and in many cases it was quite difficult to research, but it was always far more morally ambiguous, far more complex, far more nuanced than I'd ever imagined. So yes, it's shocking, but not always in the ways that you think.
That's interesting. So it's as much about what people do when they're anonymous as it is about the tools that they use to access those spaces in relative privacy. So what role do you think anonymity plays in people being able to express themselves in the dark net?
I think the question of online anonymity and I suppose the way that it can change our behaviour is one of the sort of great pressing issues that everyone's concerned about, the last couple of years especially. Well, what do people do when they are behind a screen and they think they're unaccountable for their actions? And in many cases, that is what I was searching out for. And it's absolutely true that, of course, when you feel unaccountable, when you feel like no one's watching you, you will tend to be rather more creative. You'll tend to be rather more daring. You'll tend to sate your curiosities. And that can be very destructive. Sometimes that can be incredibly helpful and very important and very interesting. I suppose I was looking at the darker places that can lead people. That's not to say it doesn't take people in very positive directions too. And I, in the end, actually concluded that either real or perceived anonymity, the idea that you can do stuff without being accountable for it, doesn't really change us. It doesn't change who we are. It just magnifies some of those urges, some of those desires, some of those behaviours that we have deep down inside of us anyway.
So some of the people that you might have encountered in these spaces, you know, they might be, you know, pretty normal in real life, but are sort of expressing some latent parts of themselves in these spaces that you visited.
Yeah, I think that's right. I take the example of neo-Nazi called Paul, who I met several times. Online, he is a ferocious neo-Nazi.
You wouldn't like have him around to dinner.
Well, that's the thing. You would have him around for dinner.
Wow.
Because offline, he is an incredibly personable, interesting, yes, very angry, very frustrated man.
So you met up with him offline?
I met up with him offline several times. And, you know, I always felt like I got on really well with him. That when I met him in person, we talked about football, we talked about our families, we looked at each other, we could relate to each other at a human level. Then every time I went back and watched him online, he appeared to be someone quite different. He was more angry, more virulent, more frustrated, more vicious, more vitriolic. And I think part of the reason for that was that he had created for himself an online persona. Somebody who within his online community of neo-Nazis was feared and respected for his, yeah, very gifted with language, but for his propaganda. He used to spend 90% of his time on the internet, he told me, pushing out propaganda. And it sort of crowded out the other parts of his identity because that's all he ever did online and that's all he ever could be online. When I met him in person, he's someone quite different.
Do you think he would have engaged in discriminatory activities in his offline life, or this was an identity he created to gain some kind of power in this underground community?
I think it's that he found online a way of getting affirmation and respect from other people that he couldn't find in the real world.
Wow.
And you know, he told me a story of one day when he was walking down a street in this very small town he lives in the north of England. He has very few opportunities to do anything with his life, frankly. And he saw a couple of sort of far-right activists walking past him, chanting about the English Defence League, a group that he quite liked. And I said to him, fantastic, you know, you could find some people like you in your area. But he told me that he didn't talk to them. He just walked straight past because he didn't know how to relate to them as the real him, because the only identity that they would have known was the digital him, the powerful, ferocious, verbose version of Paul, and not the real world one, the sort of rather quiet, rather shy 30-year-old man who doesn't really know where his life's going. And he preferred to keep those identities quite separate. The question, I suppose, and I never quite got to the bottom of it, is it an outlet? Does it mean that he's not going to do anything in the real world? Like it's somewhere for him to vent his frustration and his anger. And there's a lot of angry, frustrated people out there, of course.
Sure.
Or is it somewhere that sort of radicalises him, pushes him further and further into a violent direction? And we have cases of both. We have cases of Anders Breivik, the Norwegian terrorist who spent all his life online and became so convinced about the imminent destruction of European culture, mainly from stuff that he'd been reading on the internet, that he decided the only answer was a violent response in the real world. And then we have cases like Paul, my neo-Nazi, my affable neo-Nazi.
Your neo-Nazi pal.
My neo-Nazi friend, for whom I think it was more of an outlet. And the problem is, it affects different people in different ways, and you can never quite tell who is going to take it offline.
Yeah, wow, that certainly makes it interesting. What are some other communities that you explored for your research?
The most difficult one of all, and this really surprised me, was the pro-anorexia community.
I'm familiar with those as
well. So those groups, right, those groups that are sort of encourage this very serious eating disorder as a sort of lifestyle choice, as something that's to be encouraged among particularly young girls who are the people that frequent these sites.
And they gather and share quotes and pictures of very skinny people.
That's right. They try and inspire each other. They try to motivate each other. They give encouragement to each other. Now, here's the thing about it. You know, I expected to find a very sort of malicious, evil group of people pushing young girls into very destructive behaviours, but it's quite the reverse. This community is unbelievably loving, caring, friendly. They're always there for you. They're always supportive. And we're talking about a serious psychological illness here. When people, young people especially, are feeling very alone, they don't know where to go, they've got no one to speak to, and they go to these sites because it's a community. It's friendly and it's welcoming. But as a result, this very negative behaviour becomes part of your social life. You don't even realise it's happening to you. And, you know, you spend all of your day and your night on these sites. These are your friends. This is your community.
And they share that illness in common as a bonding feature.
And it becomes part of their identity, that I'm a pro-anorexia person. And you give them 6 months in these communities, they're incredibly unwell and they can't see it. Mm-hmm. And they're terrified about leaving these sites because this is their social life. And so it was quite the opposite of what I expected. It was the kindness and the warmth that was the most destructive thing about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think that people with serious illnesses don't choose to have those illnesses and are as such are probably capable of having a lot of empathy for each other. But I mean, sort of off topic, but I've heard and read that group therapy is a complicated proposition for girls with eating disorders because they tend to reinforce each other in that environment.
That was exactly what I saw. And, you know, the problem is that there's nowhere else for them to go. The NHS doesn't provide any service for young girls to go and talk to people that suffer like them. And as a result, there's this huge vacuum there. You know, all of us go online to check out our illnesses now. You know, if you get a little slight headache and you're straight on the internet searching out what it might be. And it's because we, in times of loneliness, we look for other people.
Oh, sure.
And you can always find other people going through the same things as you now. But because it's so unregulated, because there aren't health professionals there, and because it becomes a very closed community, outsiders aren't really welcome. And I think that is the most destructive thing. And I think it's a failing on the NHS. I think it's a failing on traditional health services who haven't worked out what do we do in a situation where people are going to join unregulated forums about their illnesses without us knowing. And they need to respond to this.
So in general, do you think some of the proliferation of these darker communities online might be various responses to infrastructures that aren't lacking and that are lacking in the real world?
Absolutely. And you know, people go and find these places often because something is missing in the real world, if you like. And in almost every case that I looked at, it was far less black and white than I expected. Let's take the drugs market. It's the notorious Silk Road drugs market, where almost any drug imaginable can be bought or sold. This is part of the Tor hidden service. This is the more traditional quote-unquote dark net.
Could you describe Tor for people listening if they're not familiar?
Yeah, sure. So Tor is it's two things, really. It's an internet browser, a bit like Chrome or Firefox, but that allows its user to browse the net without revealing the location of where that person is.
And there's so much web services these days collect our data so indiscriminately, it's easy to see why someone might be attracted to that.
A lot of people use it for really, really good purposes. And, you know, Tor, the browser, is incredibly valuable for civil rights activists, human rights activists and journalists around the world who don't want the Russian or the Chinese government to know where they are and what they're doing.
People who might be in danger because of their work.
I guarantee you that Tor has saved many people's lives, and that's one of the reasons it is funded and so beloved by civil liberties organisations. But part of what using the Tor browser also gives you is access to this encrypted internet, which uses the same non-standardised protocols to allow people to set up websites on servers that can't really be easily located either.
Hmm.
And as a result, it's a sort of strange second internet where almost anything goes.
I see.
And using Tor, you can access these sites. And there's almost anything and everything on this dark net. And this is what people think of when you talk about the dark net. They imagine this Tor network.
It's unregulated criminal underground where all the websites that aren't allowed on the nice internet go.
Exactly. Well, exactly. And it's a rather terrifying account, but of course, a lot of these websites are for whistleblowing activity. The New Yorker has a website on a Tor hidden service.
Wow.
The WikiLeaks cache is stored on a Tor hidden service. There's all manner of bizarre political websites and blogs that people set up just because they like to be in this unregulated space. And it is rather exciting and rather interesting and rather terrifying, because that is where you do find marketplaces where anything and everything is bought and sold.
Mm.
And that's where I went in one of my chapters.
I see.
And I...
what did you buy? you don't have to say.
I bought a 1 gram of marijuana.
As
an experiment, which I then disposed of carefully and documented it, of course. Now, here's the thing about these markets. You arrive at the Silk Road or one of the many other websites that there's about 30 of these anonymous
markets.
Silk
Road is an anonymous online marketplace.
It's actually Silk Road 2.0 because the original was closed down by the FBI, and within a month another one had sprung up in its place. There's 30 of these marketplaces selling more drugs than you could possibly imagine from hundreds of vendors based all around the world.
But in a way that is community regulated, in a way that, you know, offline drugs purchase and sale is not.
This is the strange thing about it. So you go onto the website and you find that it looks like Amazon in the sense that every single product, you know, marijuana and cocaine and heroin and everything, has a little picture of the product. It has a description of the product with the price and, of course, with the user reviews. User reviews, what makes e-commerce possible.
Wow.
So every drug user who uses this stuff, after having received and consumed their drug, will write an honest review of the product and give it a score out of 5. And you know what that creates? It creates competition, genuine competition between hundreds of vendors, and a way for unhappy buyers to express their frustration. And guess what happens as a result?
It's safer and more accountable. And
the product quality goes up and the price goes down and the market starts to respond to the buyer. And so, you know, I got in touch with a number of sellers. I emailed them on the internal email system and they were unbelievably attentive. They would respond to your email within a couple of hours. They would, you know, answer all of your questions. They give you free package and delivery. They compete with each other for your custom.
Like an Amazon seller.
Just like any seller in a competitive marketplace. And I saw some drug dealers offering, would you believe it, fair trade cocaine.
you know, we don't, yeah, you know, we're not buying this off Colombian.
Ethically sourced.
Some of them even purport to give 10% of their profits away to Guatemalan school projects and so on. You know, this is a genuinely competitive marketplace. So what does that do? That means that if you're ingesting drugs, you have a far more reliable system to know how pure the drug is, to make sure it's not being laced with other products. You don't have to go and hang around on street corners. It strips out the a lot of the associated crime that goes with street vending. There are a lot of benefits potentially to a marketplace, but on the other hand, it makes more drugs more available to more people more easily. So you're suddenly faced with a sort of moral dilemma, and it wasn't the one I expected. I suddenly realised there were great benefits to this potentially for the individual and for the and for society.
It's another case, just as you found with the forum for girls that had illnesses, it was a response to an infrastructure that's missing in our day-to-day lives, which is regulation and safe control of substances.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. I mean, yeah, so a functioning market that works in the interest of consumers in an industry where that's so important and where it's never really happened before. And, you know, that sort of sums up all of these communities and cultures that I looked at.
But there's a surprising upside.
There's a surprising, unexpected sort of set of quandaries even that you hadn't quite expected to find. And I hope that was really my purpose for writing this book, to get people to look just beyond the horror stories about some of these places and start thinking about what it might mean. Because I imagine that in years ahead, more and more people are going to use anonymous browsers. There's definitely a demand for it. More and more people care about their online identities. And I think all of these issues are going to continue to be important, so we need to understand them.
So where can people find your book?
Probably on the dark net, where you can no doubt get a pirated version of it.
So they can go on Tor Hidden Services and steal it.
No doubt. But if they want to purchase it in a more legal way, it's in most good bookshops and on most good online outlets too. So hopefully you shouldn't be too difficult to find.
Jamie Bartlett, author of The Dark Net, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Jamie Bartlett's The Dark Net is now out in hardback and Kindle edition and published by William Heinemann. Also, Jamie's giving a lecture this week at Imperial College London. We'll have links to that on the blog for this podcast. But that's all we have for you this week. A big thanks to the tech team, Alex Hearn, Samuel Gibbs, and Elena Cressy. Tech Weekly was presented by me, Lee Alexander, and produced by Jason Phipps. We'll be back next Wednesday. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.